From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Game one of the NBA Finals is tonight. That's a big deal for the Golden State Warriors. But their coach, Steve Kerr, who is key to their success so far, will not be on the floor with them. Why? Excruciating back pain, even after two back surgeries. And Tiger Woods is also afflicted by back pain, and he's on painkillers for it. The back pain industry is making a lot of money, but real, actual cures are rare. This hour on Point, treating back pain from the gimmicks to the true solutions. You can join us on air or online. Is back pain a problem in your life? Have you found a treatment that works or what hasn't worked for you? What would you warn other back pain sufferers away from? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. To start off this conversation, we first want to talk about back pain in the news. And for that, we turn to Kevin Blackistone. He's going to tell us about Tiger Woods and coach Steve Kerr. Kevin is a sports columnist at The Washington Post. He's also a panelist on ESPN's Around the Horn. And he's a sports journalism professor at the University of Maryland. He joins us from Silver Spring, Maryland. Kevin, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
And let's start off with a sound from CBS this morning related to Tiger Woods. As many of our listeners may know, Tiger was arrested Monday for what police thought was a DUI. And let's hear what police said about that.
Police say they found Woods asleep behind the wheel of a black Mercedes like this one. Woods told officers he had taken four medications, including the painkiller Vicodin. Woods, who is recovering from a back operation last month, said, "I understand the severity of what I did, and I take full responsibility for my actions."
So, Kevin Blackistone, it appears that there was no alcohol in Tiger Woods' system. It was medication for back pain. Tell us what he's been going through medically and surgically.
Well, Tiger has had a number of injuries crop up on him in the last several years, a number of which have required him to have surgery. And the back has been the one that seems to have been the most troubling. And what he went through recently was, I believe this is his fourth back surgery in a number of years, and it was, I guess, what they call a fusion type of surgery. And the odd thing is that he announced a week or so ago after the surgery that he had felt better than he had in a number of years. But obviously anyone who's been through back surgery or any kind of surgery knows that in the days and weeks after that, you oftentimes are on pain medication.
And he was also even having trouble standing at one point. His back had gotten that bad.
He was just having trouble standing, doing things like tying his shoes, which he struggled to do at the command of police the other night. He was just having trouble getting around. And if you watched him play golf, which he did less and less over the past couple years, there were a number of times where he would take a swing and then just buckle at the knees and grab at his back because of the pain that it was causing him. So he was in a great deal of discomfort.
And I assume that it is all his years of golf that did this. I mean, the violence in a sense of swinging thousands of times over the course of his career.
Exactly.
Imagine what that does to your anatomy.
Right. They talk about the torque that swinging a golf club, especially as viciously as he does, puts on the back. And remember, this is a guy who has golfed his entire life. I mean, that's what we know him for doing. And so there's a lot of mileage on that back, and it just eventually has given out on him.
Let's hear a piece of sound also from Steve Kerr, the Golden State Warriors coach. He's undergone two back surgeries, and they haven't worked that well, apparently. Here he is talking to reporters on April 23rd with a strong message, which is basically, do not go under the knife.
And I can tell you, if you're listening out there, if you have a back problem, stay away from surgery. I can say that from the bottom of my heart. Rehab. You know, don't let anybody get in there.
You can imagine the chatter that got going in operating rooms as someone as prominent as that said avoid. Tell us what's been going on with Steve Kerr.
Well, he had a back issue that required surgery. It did not, as he mentioned, go well. And he also had what was called a spinal cord leak procedure. And I'm not going to pretend to understand exactly what that is, but it it caused him, I can't say it caused him even more problems, but it didn't get him back upright or able to travel with the team or able to do all the things that you have to do as a coach and sit on the bench as he had hoped. And, you know, the odd thing about Steve Kerr is, in comparing him to Tiger Woods, Steve Kerr retired from being an active basketball player many, many years ago. He's also not a big guy. He's a relatively normal-sized human being. And so looking at him and knowing the type of game that he played, you would not expect that he would be a guy who would come down with back problems that might require, that might force him to retire from just being a coach, from just being able to sit on a bench and watch basketball and call out plays. But that is how bad it has become. It's become for him, and I think he was quite serious when he said, "Stay away from back surgery."
And at this point, have his doctors said how likely he is to recover? Is he in a limbo state?
It's still kind of a. I think it's still kind of a touch and go with him. There's a chance he may. I think he's going to try and soldier through these finals if he can. But he might disappear just as easily.
Kevin Blackstone is a sports columnist at the Washington Post, also a panelist on ESPN's Around the Horn, and a sports journalism professor at the University of Maryland. Kevin, thank you for that update.
Thank you.
And joining me now from San Francisco is journalist Catherine Jacobson-Raymond. She's just out with a new book about back pain and the big money being made off of it. She says it's an industry. Her book is called Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. You can find an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Catherine, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Sasha. How are you?
Good. The inspiration for your book was a personal story about back pain. Tell us a little bit about what happened to you that made you go into reporting mode.
Well, I have been an investigative reporter for about four decades. And after my first book was published in 2007, I found that I was in so much pain that although I was otherwise doing just fine, I could barely stand to walk or sit for any length of time. And I realized that before I could start on another project, I was going to have to work out what had happened and what I ought to do about it. It's been going on since I was about 16. So it was no short-term problem. And I began to investigate. I started talking with surgeons and reading. And the more I read and the more conversations I had, the more I realized that there was something very, very fishy going on. Simply was not a cut-and-dried situation. It was not like having a broken ankle fixed. There were dozens of interventions possible, very little evidence for the majority of those. And I also observed that people who had surgery did not necessarily get better.
You mentioned at age 16 you began to have this problem. Did something in particular happen that caused a back injury or back pain?
Well, you know, people are forever talking about the inciting incident about back pain. They frequently say things like, well, I leaned over to flush the toilet, or I was brushing my teeth, or I picked up a newspaper, or I took a suitcase out of a car. You know, generally speaking, those things are not enough to throw your entire system out of whack. What's generally happened is that somehow you have become deconditioned over the years. Your musculature is not well balanced. And this is kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back. In my case, what happened is that I took a very, very severe fall off a fast-moving horse onto my hip. And after that, I began to limp and hobble and use all kinds of muscles that were not the appropriate ones for my everyday activities. And I think that that kind of imbalanced my body to a point where the back pain could really become a serious problem. But it didn't until after my two children were born when I was in my 30s. And that's when I really started to experience some difficulties.
And that's when you had to get treatment and discovered that it's quite a morass out there. Now, one thing you said earlier is it's not like having an ankle fixed. But I want to give credit where credit is due to the surgical world, because even ankles and joints of any kind can be extremely complicated. It's not as if it's always straightforward. But what, to you, distinguishes the confusion and the morass of the back pain industry?
Well, you know, a spine is a very different animal from a knee or a hip. A knee is a hinge. One, you know, goes one way, basically, right? If you see your knee going the other direction, you have a very serious problem. A hip is does move in more directions than a knee, certainly. But a spine moves in so many directions. Think of all the things we do every day. Now that there are backup cams and cameras in cars, people don't turn around as much to back up, but just that kind of twist requires movement in multiple planes. Everything else we do, you know, putting a bag in the overhead compartment on a plane, I always think of that one because you have to lift it and then you have to twist drastically. These are the sorts of things that the spine must do every day. And so we cannot look at it as being the same as a knee joint or a hip joint. Because there is a significant increase in the range of movement that's required.
But did you expect treatment to be more straightforward than you encountered?
Oh, of course. You know, I thought everyone I knew had had an MRI for some reason or another of a spine, and I thought that I would simply see my primary care doctor, and he would order the MRI, and when we got the results, I would see a surgeon, and I would be, you know, on the surgical calendar almost immediately, and we'd be done in a few months. And that is not at all how it worked.
Right. You write in your book that instead you encountered a sinkhole of hype, was your term, and you talked about going to a reception room where it was just packed with people also
Absolutely.
Looking for back pain treatment, which gave you a sense of this industry. Catherine Jacobson, Raymond, hold for us while we go to a break. We're talking about back pain, about the millions of people who suffer from it, what the medical establishment and others are offering as cures, and whether those cures do or don't work. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about that common, sometimes debilitating curse of back pain and the $100 billion industry that treats it and why a lot of those billions may be wasted money. You can join the conversation. Are you on disability for back pain? Do you take painkillers? How do you treat it? Does it work for you? My guest is Catherine Jacobson Raymond, author of Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. Catherine, before the break, you were talking about how your own back pain sent you on a reporting mission to look into what you considered the back pain industry. You found that many treatments range from ineffective to wasteful to harmful. You felt like some were simply designed to drain your wallet. We'll go into detail, but first, give us an overview of what you found that left you so dismayed.
Well, as I began my research, I started looking at all of the peer-reviewed medical literature. And what I realized was that there was very, very little evidence for most of what was being offered. I learned a great deal about physical therapy and chiropractic. I discuss this at some length in the book. And although there are certainly chiropractors who have moved away from traditional chiropractic, those who have stuck with adjustments and talk about subluxations, there was virtually no evidence for that in terms of being helpful with back pain. Those chiropractors who have walked away from that and gone to rehab and intensive exercise were actually doing a great job for a lot of patients. In terms of physical therapy, I always assumed that when you got that prescription for physical therapy, you just went to the clinic that took your insurance, and that was that. And I had done that about three different times with no success, really. I had, quote unquote, failed physical therapy, as so many of us do. And what I learned was that there are some different types of physical therapy. And if you go to a large corporate-owned clinic that takes your insurance, you're probably going to see the doctorate-level physical therapist for a few minutes, and then you're going to be assigned to an assistant who is going to sort of put you through your paces, hand you a list of stick figure exercises that you're supposed to do, but that you probably aren't going to do, and then ply you with ultrasound and heat and cold packs and electrical muscular stimulation. And there's no evidence for any of those.
Well, you also found that some physical therapy clinics seem to intentionally give people poor PT so that then you fail it and then you become a legitimate candidate for surgery. And that basically enriches the medical community more.
That, yes, that was really horrifying. I mean, surgeons and other physicians can have investments in physical therapy clinics. And the way that I determined, the way I learned what you've just described is from physical therapists who told me about it, that basically the role of these clinics is largely to fluff the patient, that being the physical therapist term for it. Don't hurt the patient. Keep the patient around long enough so that the physician can then note that the patient has, quote unquote, failed physical therapy and is now a candidate for spine surgery.
And you're very dubious about spine surgery in particular. Let's hear a little piece of sound, because there are hundreds of spine clinics around the country, the number continuing to grow. They end up offering surgery and promising immediate relief. And here's a commercial for one of those.
Our experienced board-certified surgeons have a proven track record of successful minimally invasive spine surgeries. With a less than 1-inch incision, you'll be up and walking within hours of surgery, free from chronic back pain.
Catherine Jacobson-Raymond, your message there seems to be buyer beware.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I'm very familiar with that particular commercial. You know, yes, buyer beware, because first of all, although there are certain minimally invasive spine surgeries that would involve a half-inch incision, they will, first of all, are not recognized as being useful, and the bulk of those surgeries that come out of minimally invasive spine surgery clinics have much larger incisions. But the incision is not important. What is important is what is going on under the skin. And the type of damage is very, very similar to what would occur in what is known as a microdiscectomy, which is more of a conventional spine surgery. When you hear about minimally invasive surgery, they're talking about lasers. These are all buzzwords. They're very sexy buzzwords. We've been trained in some ways, because so many of us came of age with Star Wars, to think, oh, lasers, fantastic. There's not a lot of use for lasers in spine surgery, and a hot laser can be extremely dangerous because it's difficult to control.
Catherine, let's bring in the voice of a doctor. We actually have a physiatrist with me here in the studio. This is Dr. Carol Hartigan. She is medical director of the Spine Center and the Spine Rehabilitation Program at New England Baptist Hospital. She's also an assistant clinical professor in physical medicine and rehab at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Carol Hartigan, thank you for coming in.
Hi, Sasha. Thanks for having me.
So presumably your clinic does do some surgeries. Any sense of ratio of a patient who comes in who might get a surgery versus a non-surgical solution?
For us, less than 5% go to surgery.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. We really advocate against surgery, and the surgeons that I work with really don't want to operate on people if it's not going to be a very cause and effect intervention with.
Can you ever know in advance what really will be cause and effect,
though? Well, if you have a spur or a herniation that's pressing on a nerve and you've tried all the conservative treatment and the pain going down the leg is in the right distribution to be attributed to that nerve, then there's nothing wrong with going in and taking away the offensive mechanical compression.
But it sounds like then you would agree with Catherine Jacobson-Raymond that patients with back pain want to think very seriously before they decide to go and be operated on.
Very seriously, and especially for back pain alone without leg pain. That's definitely not expected to respond well to surgery.
What kind of things should they try before they go that route?
Well, for us, keep as active as possible as tolerated. Try to keep as strong as possible. Receive messages and surround yourself with clinicians who support you and give you permission to move and be active. Recognize that they might be deconditioned, that they might be guarding and fearing movement, and that they might also have hypersensitive nerves, which we call central sensitization.
Deconditioned meaning out of shape.
Deconditioned, out of shape, right.
Well, we have a number of callers who want to weigh in about their own experiences. Let's hear from several of them and then come back to Catherine and Carol. Nicholas is calling from Sarasota, Florida. Nicholas, welcome to On Point. And have you, unfortunately, had back pain issues?
Hi, yes, about 14 years ago. I was in an accident that damaged a tremendous portion of my thoracic spine and left me in pain ever since.
And what kind of treatments have you undergone?
I've run the gamut. I avoided surgery specifically because, depending on which doctor I saw, they would recommend completely different surgeries. And I was lucky that I had a non-surgical doctor who lent me books and told me to learn about the anatomy of the back so I could understand my injury. And when I started talking to these surgeons, I just didn't trust them enough.
Did you ultimately find a solution that works for you, or is this an ongoing battle?
I've found things that have worked, but the biggest problem I found for other people like me that I've met is when you do first get injured, you realize that, you know, large portions of your life, things you used to be able to do, you may not be able to do anymore.
Sure, like even sitting, sitting and standing.
Right, and or, you know, the hobbies you had, activities. And so it's easy to slip into depression. And a lot of the medication that's prescribed for back injury are sedatives, which kind of can make the depression far, far worse. Even some of the non-narcotic medications like gabapentin can really cause major depression.
Nicholas, thank you for that. We hope that your back solution, you find one permanently eventually. Let's hear from another caller. This is Daniel calling from Hollandale, Florida. Daniel, have you also had back issues?
Yes, I have, for many years. Mine started back in 1993. I ruptured a disc and herniated two lower discs in my lumbar region.
And what kind of treatment did you get?
Well, originally, I was when I was diagnosed that, they were diagnosing me for surgery. And I opted out of the surgery because I didn't like the circumstances that I was going to get out of it. So for a long time, I did all kinds of therapy using TENS units and things like that, and physical therapy, chiropractors, acupressure, and medication. Lots of medication. I would eat easily 20 Percodans a day, a couple Somas at night so I could sleep through the night, and just start my day off every day with a couple Percodans just to keep me going, which for my case, it gave me a lot of energy and I was able to continue working. I was still young, raising a family, so.
And what about now? Do you still have back pain now?
I'm in really great shape, but what happened over the years, I was kind of lucky. I kept exercising, and even when I got hurt, I would go back to exercising, and I changed my format of exercising. And what ended up happening is what was well explained to me was drop weight, let your back muscles and your abdomen muscles become your disc. Let that strength, and eventually things will happen, such as disc desiccation. Because once you have a back injury like I have, your discs will eventually all dry out as you get older and stuff.
But you never had surgery?
No, I never opted for surgery. This drying up stopped the impinging on the nerves. The pain went away for the most part. And I ended up being in great shape. I haven't taken any medication since 2012.
That's good to hear. Daniel, thank you for that call. Let's hear from Anne calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Anne, welcome to On Point. And what do you think as you listen to this conversation?
Hi, Sasha. I'm calling with the opposite recommendation from other callers. I did have a spinal stenosis at two levels of my spine. I went through all the different modalities of PT and injections, all of which helped, but I was still really suffering. I can't take anti-inflammatories, so you know it was very hard on me. And finally, the physiatrist that I was seeing said, you know, surgery is the only route to go. But I researched the doctors, I researched the hospital, I researched the condition. And as the patient, you really have to take responsibility. And
did you have surgery?
I had the surgery. I was in heaven. I mean, within days.
And how long ago was that?
This was 7 years ago. I get twinges, and I do my exercises. And something that the author that was speaking earlier said was, people don't do the exercises. And I know that that's true, but I did.
Anne, thank you for that. I'm glad that worked out well for you. Dr. Carol Hartigan of New England Baptist Hospital, you run the Spine Center and the Spine Rehabilitation Program there. We've heard mixed results from patients. For some, it worked. Well, some wanted to avoid it. We had one person who had surgery and it worked. What's your advice?
Just because you have persistent back pain does not mean that you are a surgical candidate. And exercise should always be attempted, intensive exercise. For her, it sounds like she had spinal stenosis. She probably had leg weakness, leg pain that was attributable directly to that stenosis. And if you can remove a little piece of bone, decompress that area, then that often leads to excellent results. But it's not common. It's a great case, and I'm not surprised to hear her story.
We heard someone say he dropped weight. He worked on developing his back muscles and abdominal muscles. Is that, I mean, it's hard work, but is that really sometimes what's required?
That's going to optimize whatever you're working with, right? So it's counterintuitive to say, let's move the body part that hurts. But once we can confirm that it's benign, if an MRI and a CAT scan show there's no dangerous fracture, infection, tumor, then we can all agree there's nothing unsafe, then we can do the counterintuitive thing and get that body part moving.
Catherine Jacobson-Raymond, author of Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. In your research, you came across so many people with back pain stories. Was what you just heard from our listeners a very familiar story of the range of things they tried?
Yes, that is a very familiar story. I spent some time at Dr. Hartigan and Dr. Rainville's clinic at Baptist Hospital, and I watched the sorts of rehabilitative exercise programs that went on there. You might find somebody who had been suffering from severe back pain who is now moving milk crates, plastic milk crates full of steel bricks across the room. Now, why would a back pain patient be asked to do a thing like that? Well, Dr. Hartigan mentioned fear avoidant behavior and guarding. And these are two things that are very hard to get past. As back pain patients, we are told very often by members of the medical community, be very careful, you could hurt yourself. I've had individuals tell me that their physicians told them that, you know, their backs were so bad, their necks were so bad that their heads could fall off, all kinds of absolutely absurd things that lead patients to not want to do anything. And what Dr. Hartigan and Dr. Rainville do is show patients that they don't need to be that careful, that their bodies are okay, and that hurt does not mean harm. And I think that's such a key idea, and it's expressed so well at the spine clinic and many other places in this country as well.
There was a recent infomercial put out by Johns Hopkins Medicine, obviously a well-respected institution. It features a patient, U.S. Army veteran Richard Shetter, who said he had tried many cures that didn't work, and then he tried spinal fusion surgery, and that made a big difference.
I had a couple of ruptures, bulges. Within the first meeting, he's telling me, I think we need to do a fusion, a cushion, and a decompression. And that's exactly what he did. And as soon as I woke up, I looked at him and I said, my legs don't hurt anymore. It was a miracle.
Again, an infomercial. Let's keep that in mind. But Dr. Carol Hartigan of New England Baptist, sometimes is this what's required? Sometimes you have to go to surgery.
Absolutely. And you have to decide if you want to do a simple decompression or if you want to do a fusion. If you notice that, if we know by checking x-rays that there's instability, then you can't just do a decompression because you're going to leave the back unstable. So you have to do a fusion with screws and plates and usually donor bone graft to stabilize things.
And Catherine Jacobson-Raymond, briefly before we go to a break, did you come to a conclusion in your mind on when people should turn to surgery?
Well, it's a very rare situation. That is for sure. I mean, the failure rate of spinal fusion surgery is so very, very high. And people tend to feel that they have exhausted their other options and there is no alternative. I noticed that your sports reporter before talked about how Tiger Woods required surgery. Well, that is very, very rarely the case.
So be careful with that word. Yeah.
Yes.
Catherine, hold for us if you would. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll be back. Dr. Carol Hartigan, stay with us as well. We're talking about the many ways we try to relieve ourselves of back pain and how Americans are spending billions on so-called cures that don't work. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the back pain industry, what treatments actually work and what's a waste of money. You can join the conversation. If something has worked for you, let us know. If it didn't work for you, also let us know. My guests are Dr. Carol Hartigan, Medical Director of the Spine Center and Spine Rehabilitation Program at New England Baptist Hospital, and Catherine Jacobson-Raymond, author of Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. Carol and Catherine, we are going to talk more about solutions and alternatives to surgery, but I want to talk a little about how we got here, because the CDC estimates that nearly 30% of all U.S. adults each year suffer from back pain. And by some estimates, back pain is a leading cause of disability. A comment just came in on our website, and this person writes, "I've always had some neck pain, but it became significantly worse when I started working at a desk full time. I think we have such terrible back and neck pain because we live a much more sedentary life. When are we going to wake up and realize that our lifestyles aren't really working for us?" Dr. Carol Hartigan, how much of this is the way we live and work and possibly unchangeable?
Being sedentary doesn't help at all. And the more fit and active we are, the better. The more we exercise, the better. But coming back to Tiger Woods' four surgeries, any reputable spine surgeon that I know is always taught to think very carefully about the first surgery. Think more carefully about the second surgery. And if you're talking about third and fourth surgeries, there's something going on. That's a red flag. But going back to 25 years ago when I first started, we would see people with nine surgeries. So somebody would, a doctor would say, "Oh, that one didn't work. Let's go a level higher. Let's go a level lower," and just keep adding on and until they realized that it wasn't useful. And that's the reason why I went into what I did, because it was disappointing and discouraging to see so many people unnecessarily dysfunctional.
You've been in the business a long time.
Yes.
Have you seen more people with back problems the more you've been in the industry?
It's about the same. It's a ubiquitous human problem, but a lot of what we do doesn't help. And we do string people along sometimes with unnecessary treatments, like all those passive physical therapy treatments have never been proven to do anything. The other thing about a fusion surgery is that when you do a fusion at a particular level, that level is no longer taking the stress and the brunt of the stresses of life. And so a level above and the level below becomes susceptible to more intensive degeneration. That's called adjacent segment syndrome.
Catherine Jacobson-Raymond, in your research for your book, Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery, what did you find in terms of lifestyle? I mean, all these kids that spend a lot of time slumped on a couch with an iPad, not exercising as much as maybe previous generations, are they all destined for back pain? Are we doing this to ourselves?
I do believe that we're going to see a great deal more back pain in this digitally oriented generation coming up now. They're very young. They're not even adolescents yet. And they've spent very little time swinging from the monkey bars and climbing trees because their parents have thought that it was better to leave them to their own devices, which happen to be digital devices that you use on a sofa. And I've certainly seen a great deal of this going on in this younger generation through the teenage years, and for people in their 20s as well. They're just not as inclined to move as we were because they have the whole world at their fingertips, or at least they think they do.
And is the downside there that we're not developing muscles that help with posture,
right,
and spinal structure?
Very much so. And posture is a tremendous problem. And people think, oh, posture. Well, you just say, stand up straight, and then you do. But that is not really how it works. People whose posture is really not very good often lack the muscular strength and the ligament strength to hold their own bodies up. And I had that problem myself. I had spent many, many years sitting at a desk working very intently. I was a tall, thin person, and I discovered that I really did not have the necessary musculature to hold my own body perfectly erect. And because of that, certain muscles were being employed that should not have been. And that really was responsible for my leg pain. Dr. Hartigan spoke about, you know, the potential for surgery with leg pain, for leg pain. But what I've seen over and over again is patients who have leg pain, who begin a serious rehabilitation program, and who don't have leg pain at the end, and who definitely don't need surgery. And more often, I've also seen people who have leg pain and go in for surgery, and they don't get better, and they don't walk again. I was sitting in a cafe 2 days ago chatting with a gentleman who saw my book. I was doing some work, and he saw my book on the table, and he asked me some questions. And he said that he went in for his leg pain, and he hasn't been out of that wheelchair in 5 years now.
We're talking about back pain and the industry that's grown up around it, the sometimes dubious industry in the view of our guest, Catherine Jacobson-Raymond. Let's go to some of our listeners. Many On Point listeners want to weigh in about their own back pain experiences. Inez is one of them. She's calling from Boca Raton, Florida. Inez, what's your experience with back problems?
Well, my mother and I both have chronic conditions. My mother's is more significant, and hers started with a car accident, and her cousin, who is a doctor, advised her not to get surgery for her specific type of spinal problem, and she has tried physical therapy, and she does not take any pain meds. She rejected OxyContin from the beginning because she hated the side effects. She takes no pain meds now since 1999. And she is very careful about the type of furniture. She advocates against soft, fluffy furniture. She makes sure that the distance between her knees and where her back begins is the right distance so that she's not sitting in a weird contortion when, you know, so that her, she's all perfectly aligned. And hard furniture, like perfectly molded plastic chairs, like lawn furniture that's for, you know, short people, which is what she needs, is perfect for her and helps take her pain away. She walks a lot.
Inez, thank you for that. Dr. Carol Hartigan in the studio with me, I saw you nod at one point. Is it true about soft furniture? Tell us about how soft and hard furniture
generally, although individuals vary with what works for them, it's a little bit individual, but generally a little bit of cushioning with some firmness underneath it, but not something you have to sink into and have difficulty getting out of.
Let's hear from another caller. This is Dawn calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Dawn, your experience with back pain?
Hi, Sasha. Wonderful conversation we're having here today, and I agree with many of the points that both Catherine and Dr. Hartigan are making, but there's a couple points I wanted to make. One, Steve Kerr and Tiger Woods can both afford the best surgeons in the world. Still had failure. So what chance does the general public have with regards to back pain? It's hard, I think, to call back surgery even a last resort when everyone has agreed today that it's not the first resort, and historically it's had such a poor rate of success.
Well, that's a great point. If it doesn't work for Tiger and Kerr, what about the rest of us? That's a great point.
Right. It is really important.
Go ahead, Don. We'll come back in a minute. Go ahead, Don.
Oh, I'm sorry. The other point I wanted to make is I wanted to take issue a little bit with Catherine saying that there's no evidence for traditional chiropractic. I would encourage her to check out Dr. Heidi Havik of New Zealand, who's the leading chiropractic researcher in the world. And what has changed over the course of time is our understanding of what a subluxation is and what an adjustment is and what they accomplish. I don't want to mislead people to think, because this is the general perception of the public, that chiropractors are primarily back and neck pain doctors. What they are neurological doctors. They're treating the nervous system. Relief from back pain and neck pain is a side product. So that being said, the curse of the industry is that chiropractors do all kinds of different things, and you have to do your research, as the one caller said, because there's lots of different techniques out there.
Don, thanks for that. Catherine Jacobson-Raymond, I know from your book that you're skeptical about chiropractic. You quote H.L. Mencken, the famous social critic back in the 1920s, and he said at one point, the backwoods swarm with chiropractors. So even 100 years ago, he was skeptical. What's your view of chiropractic?
Well, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, many chiropractors have left what we know as traditional chiropractic, the cracking, the adjustments of subluxations, and they've moved into intensive rehabilitative exercise, and they're doing an excellent job with that. Some of them are, you know, they are stellar. There's a gentleman named Craig Liebenson in Los Angeles who has been retraining young chiropractors in these methods. And I think they're really helping a lot of people. It's excellent. But I don't like hearing that chiropractors are neurological doctors. And I'm pretty sure that Dr. Hartigan doesn't like hearing it either.
Dr. Hartigan, do you?
I definitely don't. And, you know, I've heard so many stories of people going in with their back pain and being told that we're going to start with the neck and then we're going to work our way down and it's going to be 3 times a week and then 2 times a week and it might take us a year or two. So I don't recommend endorse or prescribe chiropractic. However, a chiropractor who's recommending intensive exercise, I think, is a different story.
Let's go to Donnie calling from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Donnie, your experience with back pain?
Yes, Sasha. Well, thanks for taking my call. Mine is my wife's. She's back in '93. We had a pretty severe accident, and I walked away from it, but she had been twisted around in like a 45-degree angle at that time. And we spent several years without any issue whatsoever. But over the last 5 years, she began experiencing what they call restless leg syndrome. You know, her legs would go into shakes, but there was no pain. And it moved on to where she was beginning to have pain to the point she would lose feeling in her lower extremities. And anyway, we went to the doctor about it, and they immediately put her into a back surgeon over here in Oklahoma, and he told her that she had a degenerative spine and that the vertebrae were falling apart, and this is what was causing the problem. So he wanted to go in and do fusion rods. Well, both of us, being as naive as we were, thought, you know, doctor knows best, so we allowed him to go in and do this surgery. And then almost a year later, she had to go through a neck surgery, which was 2 more fusion rods. And since then, she's been in pain management. At one point, brought all the way up to a full backpack full of medication. I mean, it was unreal, the medicines that they had her on. And it's extended there from there. Now, even still in pain management, she's still not able to function properly. Both surgeries have failed. They've tried several different pain management procedures. One of them was Mr. Kerr, the coach, that prompted me to make the phone call. He had a spinal leakage problem, as that gentleman had mentioned, which is actually where one of the pain management therapies. They go in and they do an injection of some sort. Anyway, they actually puncture the sac that goes around the spinal column, and that allows fluid to leak out.
You know, Donnie, it's terrible to hear that almost 25 years after that accident, you and your wife and family are still dealing with that. I'm sorry to hear that. Dr. Carol Hartigan, for someone who's been through surgeries that haven't gone well, what do you do for someone like this?
Well, first of all, if they had an accident in 93 and she didn't have symptoms until about 5 years ago, it's hard to attribute the symptoms to the accident. And the degeneration of the spine is normal. I presume she's over 30, 40, how old is she?
46.
Right, so that it's normal and natural to have quote-unquote degenerative spine, dried-up discs, bulging discs. 30% of people over 40 have even a disc herniation that's clinically silent. As people get older, more and more of us have spinal stenosis, which may be clinically silent as well. So we don't treat the scan, we treat the person. And it doesn't sound like she was a good surgical candidate to start with. And it doesn't sound like she was offered any other options.
Catherine Jacobs at Raymond, let's talk a bit about solutions. We've heard about some. We have some listeners on Twitter who've weighed in. Someone says, exercise helps, PT didn't, I won't take meds. Another says yoga, chiropractic, and core exercises are the answer. Someone else, a woman named Marion on her website, goes into great detail about how many minutes she swims every day and how many days a week and walking. What else can people do to avoid drugs, the knife, anything invasive?
Well, the first half of my book is called Problems, and the second half is called Solutions. And I tell people that they can read that in any order, because many people coming to this book are so desperate that they they're not as interested in making it through all the problems. They need to go straight to the solutions. The gentleman that just called, I just want to say that besides being an extremely sad story, this is Donnie, whose wife is in so much pain. It's an extremely common story. You have no idea how many times I have heard that. And basically, there are a lot of cowboys out there who really want to be heroes, who want to say to a patient, you know what, I can fix this thing. One thing I want to leave you with here is that if you see a surgeon and a surgeon says, you know what, there's nothing I can do to help you, it does not mean that that surgeon is not bright enough to help you or that that surgeon does not want to help you. It means that you are not a candidate and you should not then proceed to several more surgeons, because you will find one who will say to you, I can help you, I can have you back running marathons in 6 weeks. And that is where people get into terrible trouble. They go out looking for a hero, they find one, and Donnie's story is often the result. Now, let me move to solutions. I began this investigation myself. So as many modalities and options as I could personally investigate, I did. Otherwise, I spent a great deal of time talking with other people who had been through them, et cetera. And I tried to look for what works for a lot of people. The kind of program that is run at Baptist with Dr. Hartigan and Dr. Rainville, it's extraordinarily successful. It's quite marvelous. And so that's an intensive exercise program.
Catherine, we have about a minute left, so let me give the final word to Carol Hartigan, who you just mentioned, who's with me in the studio. Dr. Hartigan, sometimes do you simply have to say to people, we can't help you much, but we can help you manage your pain?
Right, and we can help you improve your function, and we can help you believe that it's safe. And the other thing is that exercise in any form, there's a million different ways to exercise, changes the inflammatory processes in the body and reduces the oxidative chemical stressors, and also makes, in the animal settings, less pain behavior.
But some exercises maybe could aggravate a problem. Some yoga positions, for example.
Exercise or position that's tolerated, I recommend. I do not tell people don't do any particular thing or give them a specific prescription from any activity, as long as they tolerate it and do it gradually.
Thank you to both of you. That was Dr. Carol Hartigan of New England Baptist Hospital. She's medical director of the Spine Center there. And Catherine Jacobs at Raymond, who has a new book out called Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. Thank you very much. And thanks to our listeners who called. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.